Good afternoon. Before I get into the sermon, I should say happy solstice. That's what today is. Actually, about 2 hours ago, a little over 2 hours ago, was the solstice. I learned something about the solstice this year. You're never too old to learn. I always thought that the sunset got earlier and earlier until today. Anybody else? Does anybody know that that's not true? It's not true. It has to do with the way our clocks are set and when the actual solar noon is. But the fact is, it was about 2 weeks ago. 10th, December 10th, whatever that is, 11 days ago. It was on December 10th was the earliest sunset. And the latest sunrise is going to be in another, 11 days or something. It works. That's the way it works out. Just learned that this year. So there you go. If you don't learn anything else today, you learn that. This sermon actually is motivated by the time of year that we're in, but don't think you know how yet. It was late in the 7th century B.C. Israel, the northern kingdom, had been conquered and taken into captivity by the Assyrians over 100 years before. Many Israelites had moved south to Judah. I just read this week that Jerusalem had experienced a population explosion at this time. Lots of people moved from Israel, that ones who hadn't been taken into captivity. They moved down to Judah. Some remained in the land, along with the imported Assyrians. These people became known as the Samaritans, those people who were so despised by the Jews in the New Testament. Josiah, you know who Josiah was, and I think Hugh's even spoken about him. He reigned from about 640 to 609. He was a good king of Judah. He instituted many reforms. During his reign, Babylon conquered the Assyrian Empire. This happened in 609, and that was after destroying its huge capital city at Nineveh, which it had destroyed in 612 B.C. So there was a momentary power vacuum, a little bit of struggle between Assyria and Babylon as to who was going to be in charge, and some of the smaller nations around took advantage of that. And there was a bit of a power vacuum in the area where the northern tribes were, even though they had been taken into captivity. Josiah expanded his influence and Judah's influence up into the northern kingdom. And when he had that Passover, this is the first Passover that had been observed that way since the time of Joshua. It says that many Israelites came or people from the northern kingdom came down and worshiped on that Passover with them. This would have been somewhere around 622. It was Josiah's 18th year, if I remember correctly. You also might remember the story that Josiah foolishly got involved in this battle that didn't really involve him or involve Judah, the battle between Babylon and Assyria, and also to the south where you had the Egyptians. So the pharaohs were involved. And neither Egypt nor Assyria wanted Babylon to be the new world power. And it just so happened that Pharaoh Necho II, Pharaoh Necho II, was traveling up past Judah, which is what you have to do if you want to go from Egypt up to get toward Babylon or Assyria. And as he traveled up, Josiah took his troops and decided to fight Pharaoh. He had been warned not to, according to the record we have in the Bible. He'd been warned not to, and it turned out it cost him his life. Of course, the reason he had attacked is that the Pharaoh was allied with Assyria. So you try to pick your battles, but in this case, he should have stayed out of it, and he ended up losing his life. His son was appointed king, but his son was imprisoned in Egypt by the Pharaoh because he was perceived to be a not very cooperative vassal king. And we say these were kings, but see, there were empires that were in charge. And this son wasn't very cooperative, so he was sent to Egypt and he was imprisoned. They installed his younger brother to be a little bit more cooperative, as in send the money. Make sure you send the money. Make sure you tax your people. Make sure you send us the money. So why all this introduction here? Well, at this point, the stage is set for the end. And what happened is what we're going to cover today. What happened, a little bit. And also, I think, maybe something that we can learn from it. I'm going to start in 2 Kings chapter 23. 2 Kings 23 and verse 33. Now, the details from this this story come in, or they're in several different places in the Bible, but we'll start in 2 Kings 23 and verse 33. It says here that Pharaoh Necho put him in bands. Now, we're talking about his Josiah's son, who is it, Jehoaz, I think? If I can, yes, Jehoaz. Put him in bands at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem, to put the land to tribute, and he put the land to tribute to 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. Now, this Riblah was supposed to be a town up on the Orontes River, north of Damascus. And interestingly enough, we've talked about Antioch before. Antioch is on the Orontes River, further north. But this is all going a little bit north of Israel. Pharaoh Necho just happened to be there. We'll find somebody else who happened to be there a little later for a particular reason. It says in verse 34 that Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room or in the place of Josiah his father. And he turned his name, I'm reading from the King James, turned his name to Jehoiakim and took Jehoaz away, and he came to Egypt and died there. And Jehoiakim gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give the money according to the commandment of Pharaoh, and he exacted the silver and the gold of the people of the land. Everyone gave according to the taxation to give unto Pharaoh. Why would Pharaoh change the king's name? I never thought about this before. You make this guy king, and then you change his name. Why do you do that? It just shows you have total control. I'm making him king, and I'm going to even change his name. Just so you know, I'm in charge. He's not in charge. And it just makes the point. I think that's what the commentaries say. That's why that kind of thing happens. Well, that was what Pharaoh did and his interaction with Judah, which was fairly close to Egypt. Meanwhile, up north, Babylon and Assyria had been battling it out, and Babylon got the upper hand, and Nebuchadnezzar became the king of Babylon. And the Assyrians had already been defeated. The Egyptians thought they'd do battle, so they come up to the Euphrates, and Nebuchadnezzar defeats Pharaoh at the Euphrates, at the Battle of Carchemish. So now we have Egypt not a power anymore. We have Assyria not a power anymore. Assyria is the empire, or the nation, if you want to call it that, that had taken the northern tribes into captivity. And now we have Babylon in charge in the person of Nebuchadnezzar. And if we look at chapter 24 in 2 Kings, where we are, it says, in his days, it's talking about the Jehoiakim, in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years, and he turned and rebelled against him. So Jehoiakim agreed to give the tribute to Babylon now, to Nebuchadnezzar, and he agreed to do it for 3 years. And he had to deal right now with Nebuchadnezzar. So, you know, if you were Israel, or you were if you were Judah, the political landscape was changing all the time because you were a small-time power, and there were these huge powers, huge empires around you, and you had to play your game and figure out, you know, who am I going to be loyal to, and who am I going to pay off in order to, decide to, live for one more day, put it that way. If you look down at verse 7, while we're here, it says, the king of Egypt came not again any more out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken him from the river of Egypt unto the river of Euphrates, everything that had pertained to the king of Egypt. So Egypt had, in a sense, trying to claim the empire of their allies, Assyria. And they went all the way up to Babylon, or from your perspective, went all the way over toward Babylon to the Euphrates River to do battle, to claim everything between there and the Nile. And Babylon sent them home packing, and then Babylon was indisputed or undisputed ruler at that time. That's about 605 BC. Now let's turn to Daniel. I'm going to come back here to 2 Kings if you're flipping back and forth, but I'm going to go to Daniel, the book of Daniel. This message today is not going to be very long, and it's going to make basically one point. Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. All right, and what did we read before? It said that Jehoiakim decided to serve Nebuchadnezzar for 3 years. So what happened after 3 years? Well, he rebelled. What does rebel mean? Rebel means I'm not sending you the money this year. Okay. So in the third year, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Why? Well, obviously because these people have decided to challenge your authority. And it says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spoke unto Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes. So here we read in the book of Daniel that this Jehoiakim, who was the king, he was kind of a puppet king, he decided, I don't want to be puppet king anymore. I don't want to keep trying to collect all these taxes and send money up to Babylon. And they're kind of far away, and they got their own battles, and there's other, you know. So you try to figure out the lay of the land, and you think, I can get away with this. They're too busy fighting battles somewhere else. I'm not going to send a tribute this year. And Nebuchadnezzar said, yeah, yes, you will. And he came down with his armies to Jerusalem. And he made his point, and he took the money that he wanted to take, he took what he needed to take, and he took some people, including Daniel. He took some of the young and the brightest type people. There's two reasons for that. I can think of two. I mean, why would you do that? Why would you go down and get these people that are causing a little bit of trouble, and not only do you take your taxes, but you take some of their top folk with you? Why would you do that? I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer here. Yeah. I never thought about that before. I thought, take Daniel because he's a smart guy and they can put him to work up there. But it all makes them weaker down there. It's killing two birds with one stone. You make yourself stronger, you make them weaker. Seems to be smart. So they took some of the leadership back to Babylon with them. This is the first of three instances we're going to read about where Babylon came to Jerusalem and challenged the Jews, the kingdom. And so sometimes I know when I've, in the past, I've read, well, I can remember reading somewhere it says, well, Judah fell in 605 to 586 or 585. You know, it's like it took them 20 years to fall. Well, the thing is, they weren't completely done in until the end of that 20 years. But it took three different invasions, if you want to put it that way, until the deal was sealed completely. And we'll see that as we go through here. Back to 2 Kings, in chapter 24. The way the writer of the book of Kings puts it, it says, of course, Jehoiakim became a servant for 3 years, and then he turned and rebelled against him. And it says, the Lord sent against him bands of the Chaldees, bands of the Syrians, bands of the Moabites, and bands of the children of Ammon. And he sent them against Judah to destroy it according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by his servants, the prophets. So Judah's being punished, even though they haven't totally been conquered or destroyed yet. They've been conquered, but they haven't been destroyed. They're being punished. It says, surely at the commandment of the Lord came this upon Judah, to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he did. Sometimes God has a long memory, and Manasseh, of course, had been particularly evil, and punishment was promised, and punishment was coming. If, we'll come back here, if you want to look at 2 Chronicles, one verse in 2 Chronicles, which also talks about this, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, and I'll start in verse 6. And the verses before this just talk about how the things that we've already talked about. And it says in verse 6, against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and bound him in fetters to carry him to Babylon. We don't read that in the other account. We got to go here to find out that he actually was imprisoned and taken away to Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar also carried of the vessels of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in the temple of Babylon. And we heard about that. So Jehoiakim is taken captive because he rebelled. And he's taken to Babylon. And, of course, there's another king made king in his stead, Jehoiakim, this time. Now I'll go back to 2 Kings again. In 2 Kings, again in chapter 24. And we're talking about Jehoiakim in verse 8. And he was 18, he reigned in Jerusalem for 3 months, and so who his mother was and so forth, he did evil. And at that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. This is the second time. This is somewhere around 597. But notice what he did. Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother and his servants and his princes and his officers, and the king of Babylon took him in the 8th year of his reign. So he surrendered. So you have a siege and you have a surrender, which is one of the easiest ways to solve a siege. It says in verse 13 that he carried out of the house of all the treasures of the house of the Lord, all the treasures of the king's house, cut in pieces all the vessels of gold that Solomon the king of Israel had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Lord had said. And he carried away all Jerusalem, all the princes, and all the mighty men of valor. Here we go again. Sue said, you're going to really weaken them now. He can take away all the people that mount anything. Even 10,000 captives, all the craftsmen and the smiths, the people that know how to make stuff. And none remained except the poorest people of the land. And he carried away Jehoiakim to Babylon, and the king's mother, and the king's wives, and his officers, and the mighty of the land, who had carried into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And all the men of might, even 7,000, and craftsmen and smiths, 1,000, and all that were strong and apt for war, even them the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. So it sounds like he didn't leave anything that was, that didn't leave any resistance. Didn't leave the kind of people or the kind of technical knowledge, whatever would be needed to fight any wars after this. This was 597. This was the second of three sieges, we can call them that. In verse 17, it says, the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother, king in his stead. His uncle. Uncle Matt got to be the king, and he changed his name to Zedekiah. So once again, we're going to change the guy's name. We're going to show who's really in charge. And Uncle Matt's now Uncle Zed. And he was king, but he also rebelled. He also rebelled from being a vassal king. And this resulted in another siege, this time in 588 B.C. So here were three different sieges, which, now you can kind of see why it's not always clear. We say, when did Judah fall? Well, it kind of fell three different times. 2 Kings still. Let's move down to chapter 25. Came to pass in the 9th year of his reign, in the 10th month, in the 10th day of the month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his hosts, all his armies, against Jerusalem, and pitched against it, and they built forts against it round about. And the city was besieged until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. So from 588 to 586, Jerusalem was besieged again. The 10th day of the 10th month was 8 days ago. It was two Fridays ago. So that's the connection with the season. is that this siege is still in the memory of the Jews. You can find it on a Jewish calendar as a fast day. It's a remembrance of the beginning of the siege, not the end of it, but the beginning of it, when Nebuchadnezzar came, and for the third time now, to put his stamp on Judah. Only this time it was complete. This time it was complete. There was one break, actually. If I can turn somewhere else, Jeremiah chapter 37, verse 5. If you want to write that down. Here's another way that sometimes you could get out of a siege for a little while, or maybe a long while. Jeremiah 37 and verse 5 tells us that Pharaoh's army came forth out of Egypt, and when the Chaldeans that had besieged Jerusalem heard tidings of them, they departed from Jerusalem. So if you're lucky, while you're being besieged, there's some kind of a conflict will come up somewhere else, and the army might leave you alone. Well, they did leave them alone. They left. They went down and took care of the Egyptians, and they came back. So it was just a temporary break. It didn't solve Judah's problem. Just for a few minutes, let's talk about sieges. I don't know what you think about a siege. I don't know what I thought before. I did a little research on it. I mean, we don't fight wars like that in the same way as wars used to be fought. But when you think about battles in the time, you know, these are, I guess it's the Iron Age or a little bit after maybe. You know, these battles, and how did they do it? Well, they had walled cities, and you somehow or another had to attack a walled city. So if you were Pharaoh, or you were, in this case, let's say Nebuchadnezzar, and you came down to Jerusalem, what do you seek to do when you lay siege to Jerusalem? In 588, it wasn't December 13th then, the Jewish calendar is very early this year compared to the Gregorian calendar. Normally, it would have been in January, and it was in January in 588. In January of 588, what was Nebuchadnezzar, or what was he attempting to do by laying siege? What does that mean when they say he laid siege to the city? What did he do? What did an army do when they laid siege? Think out loud. What kind of things?
Camp outside the city.
And why would they do that? What were they trying to accomplish by doing that?
Well, they were trying to scare the people in the city into surrendering.
Okay, that's a really good point. Trying to scare. I wouldn't have thought of that. It's like when you lay siege to a city, I'm thinking of all kinds of other things that we'll talk about in a minute. But the very first thing you're trying to do is scare them. And I hadn't thought about that. But in 2 Kings 18, you remember the story of, what's the guy's name? It began with an R. Now I can't remember. 2 Kings 18, Rabshakeh maybe? And verse 19. Yeah, Rabshakeh said unto them, speak now unto Hezekiah. This says the great king, the king of Assyria. What do you have confidence in? You know, they had this huge army outside. And they sent people up to the wall to intimidate the Jews. And remember Hezekiah, he took it seriously and he took it to God and so forth. And God delivered them. But the very first, and I wouldn't have said this, I'm amazed you said it. The very first thing you try to do is you try to scare them. Maybe you won't even have to fight a battle. You just show up with a huge army and they're going, I give up. That's one thing you can accomplish with a siege. How about if that doesn't work? What else are you trying to do by camping outside the city?
Cut off food supply.
What other supplies, maybe? Water. What other supply? Or maybe this is the wrong kind of a word, not exactly a supply. What else are you trying to cut off when you camp outside the city?
Communication with anybody else.
Yeah, communication. You know, how are you going to send out for help? Or if you do, how are they going to get there? They got to go through this army to come help. Let's say, you know, Jehoiakim might have said he wanted Egypt. Or Zedekiah at this point. Maybe Zedekiah would want Pharaoh to come help. Well, he can't even get a message out to Pharaoh. Or if he can, Pharaoh knows he's got to go through the Babylonians to get to Jerusalem and help. Why would he want to? So you're cutting off supplies of food. You're just cutting off supply of water, perhaps. And you're cutting off communication with the outside world. You're also doing one other thing that I can think of. Maybe there are others. You're preventing what?
Yeah.
You're making it not possible for people to leave. You're keeping them from escaping. So you're doing all that. Anybody ever been to Jerusalem here? I haven't. But as far as water supply and food supply, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Just keep talking about what you, if you're attacking, if you're the besieging army, what are you trying to do? All right, you're trying to cut everything off, but some cities are very well prepared for all this. We'll talk about that in a minute. Or maybe we should talk about it as we go. What if you're a city like Jerusalem, which was a very small city before David got there, but it had become very large and very, you know, well fortified. What did you do to try to be prepared for something like Nebuchadnezzar camping outside? What kind of things did you do?
They built underground canals for water in
the city. Hezekiah's tunnel. Got a place for some spring outside the city to bring water in the city. So they realize that it's a potential that you're going to be, that somebody's going to lay siege to you and you got to have water. What else did they do?
Stored grain.
Stored grain and oil and wine. They had storehouses. In Masada, as later on, New Testament times, they lasted for a long time with their granaries and so on before the famine, took over. So you're trying to prepare by having things there. Let's go back to the besieging army. One of the things that the city has done over the course of time in this period is every city that had people in it that wanted to defend themselves had what? Had their own army, but in terms of construction, what did they have?
They had walls.
They may have had other things, depending on the lay of the land. Jerusalem was up on a hill, so it not only did it have walls, but you had to go up a hill to get to the wall. So they really had a height advantage. A lot of cities, if you visit in southern Italy, there are cities perched up on top of hills with walls that were to protect them from pirates in the Mediterranean in years past. And they're wonderful tourist places. But boy, you got to climb and climb and climb. It's way up. So that's what Jerusalem was like. Jerusalem had a double wall. Part of the wall was double. And it was hard to get to because it was up. You had to go up high before you even get to the wall. So if you were the invading army, what did you do? How could you even think of getting in? All right, you try to starve them out, but maybe you're not going to wait that long.
Well, they built they got the ground and
built ramps.
Ramps up to the walls.
They built ramps so that they could get up more level with the city in the first place. That's Romans did that. That's how they attacked Masada. They built a ramp to get there. The ramp's still there, right? I read that. You can see it. How'd they get in through the gates? Knock, have a horse? No. Battering rams. And if you had a battering ram, now there were different kinds. The simplest battering ram's a great big thing and a bunch of guys carrying it. What's the problem with that? People up on the, you know, up on the wall throwing stuff at you, throwing, you know, heavy things that are going to land on your head. So one of the war machines that had been developed was a battering ram with a roof. It was all a big structure you kind of brought up, and so they were protected from what's going, you know, all the things that might get thrown at you, and they try to batter. There's a picture from Lachish, I think it is, of the Assyrian battering ram that actually has wheels, three wheels on each side. You could wind this thing back. I said wind it up. You'd have to push it. But so there were different ways of trying to attack the gates. Of course, if you were on the inside, what did you do?
Fortify
the gates. And how did you do that? Different ways. Strong gate. Put a bar through it. Same way we can kind of keep gates closed today. Amos chapter 1 verse 5. You don't need to turn there, but sometimes we miss. not some, always. We miss these things because we're not thinking like they were thinking. Amos chapter 1 and verse 5 says, I will also break the bar of Damascus. What's that mean? You talk about the bar that was holding the gate shut. I wouldn't have thought of that if I wasn't looking into sieges and so forth. Isaiah 22 and verse 10 says, find it. You have numbered the houses of Jerusalem and broke down houses. I'm sorry, and the houses you have broken down to fortify the wall. So you try to make the wall stronger, actually, by tearing houses down that aren't being lived in anymore because those people got killed or deported or whatever. So that's another thing that happened on the inside. So you build walls, ramps. Another thing that you would do if you were attacking, and I wouldn't have thought of this either, is that if you're going to be there long enough, you build a tower to get your height, to even the height advantage or take away the height advantage of the people on the inside. So you actually build a tower that you can look down on the wall, and then you can direct your fire in that direction or keep them clear. Sometimes, every once in a while, and Alexander the Great was known for doing this, every once in a while, if you thought you had a powerful army and you had enough guts, they just scaled the wall. They just went over with a ladder. But that's really dangerous, obviously, because you got to be prepared for what's coming down at you. And I don't know how they did that and how they distracted. Maybe you use distraction. You think they're coming in here and you come in somewhere else or whatever. I don't know. No expert there. Remember in the New Testament, it talks about the quenching the flaming darts of the devil or something like that? Flaming arrows, right? That's another weapon. You set fire to things inside by sending flaming arrows in. Or outside. I read that it worked both ways. Excuse me. One other thing, if you were on the inside defensively, and I hadn't thought of this, is not only are you trying to supply make sure you have enough supplies to last, but you try to deny supplies to the enemy. In fact, 2 Chronicles, again, chapter 32, is an example of that. 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 4. It says, they were gathered, this is breaking into the thought here, it doesn't matter. They were gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? So if you know they're going to be out there, the army's coming and you've got advance notice that they're coming, you go out, plug up all the wells, you do what you can to make it harder on them to live as well. So there's all kinds of strategies if you're involved in a siege. Simplest one being, hopefully you just get scare the people and off they go. In Ezekiel chapter 21, that's one other place we can find out something about this time. Ezekiel 21 and verse 18. It said, the word of the Lord came unto me again, saying, also you, son of man, appoint you two ways, that the sword of the king of Babylon may come. Both twain shall come forth out of one land and choose you a place, choose you the head of the way to the city. Appoint a way that the sword may come to Rabbath of the Ammonites and to Judah in Jerusalem, the defensed. For the king of Babylon stood at the parting of the way at the head of the two ways to use divination. He made arrows bright. He consulted with images and he looked in the liver. And his right hand was the divination for Jerusalem, to appoint captains to the mouth of the slaughter and to lift the voice with shouting and so forth. So that's an oracle there that has to do with the king of Babylon, as if he can't figure out which way to go. Now, why is that there? Well, the reason is because I talked to you about Rabbah up to the north on the Orontes River. When Nebuchadnezzar came, he wasn't just coming to fight Judah. He also had to fight Tyre. It wasn't just Judah that was challenging him. He had to fight Tyre on the coast. He had to fight this other place in the Ammonites, a place called Rabbah of the Ammonites. Had to fight the Ammonites and he had to fight Judah. And apparently he used divination. You know, arrow, like a lot, you know, arrow, which, where does it land? That decides what we'll do. They also looked in body parts of animals to figure things out in the liver. And what was the other thing? Images, consulted with his images. So he's trying to figure out which way to go. What does that mean? He's going to attack all three. Which order do I go in? And apparently he had ruled Tyre out because it doesn't mention it here in Ezekiel. Tyre had been ruled out from the beginning because that was the toughest of the three battles. So which of the two do we need to decide? So he had camp up there. And that's typically, you noticed before, that's what had done, what had been done. Even Pharaoh had a camp up there where the king had to be taken up there. When he was captured, and they made a new king. But it happened up there. He didn't actually have his presence in Jerusalem at first. He was more of a headquarters up there where he was going to deal with the whole area. So you'd come out in the winter, maybe because it was better weather. better for fighting. It wasn't so hot. And you'd come and you'd come west from Babylon, west from your, for you, come over toward the Levant, you know, toward the Mediterranean, and pick your battles then. And you had three cities you had to deal with, and he was trying to pick which one to attack first. Which one to attack first, I should say. So I'm back in 2 Kings. I'm just giving a lot of detail here. Hopefully, when you read through these stories of the battles, it might make it a little bit more interesting. Also, just to know a few of the details. But I have a reason for going through this. It's not just to share details of warfare in this time. This particular siege in 2 Kings 25, notice verse 1, it says, "It came to pass in the ninth year of his reign, in the tenth month," in the tenth, as I read before, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came and all of his hosts against Jerusalem and pitched against it, and they built forts against it round about. So they had built it in a way. Does anybody have the New American Standard? It doesn't say forts, and I don't have it. I don't have it with me. Nobody has the New American Standard or another translation. Say walls.
It's a siege wall.
Yeah, siege wall. They built siege walls. Thank you. I didn't write it down, and here I brought the King James with me. I said that's not what it says. They built. So that's one of the things that you did. If you needed to attack a city like Jerusalem, which is way up on a hill and had walls, you had to build walls to get even close to where you could do it, and that's what. Apparently what Nebuchadnezzar did. Verse 2, we'll just keep reading here. "And the city was besieged into the 11th year of King Zedekiah," so that's several years, between 2 and 3 years. Well, actually, this one wasn't. This one was only, I think, 18 months. And one of the things that happened here is that the famine got very, very severe. It was long enough that their food supplies ran out. Also, as we already read, the top leadership, the military people, they were gone. They were already taken away. So it says, "On the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine prevailed in the city, and there was no bread for the people of the land. And finally, the city was broken up. The Babylonians were able to get through." And then I said, look, this is what amazed me. And I don't know why it amazed me, but they didn't have any real leaders left. All the top leaders had been deported, right? So when the Babylonians get the upper hand, what's the first thing that happens? It says they fled. Not the people, but the kings, the king and the men of war. They all try to get away. So much for staying there and, you know, fighting the battle and leading your people. They left. It says, "And the Chaldees were against the city round about, and the king went his way toward the plain. And the army of the Chaldeans pursued after the king and overtook him in the plains of Jericho, and all his army were scattered from him. And they took the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah." Again, he wasn't there. He was up there at this other place where he could coordinate all three battles at the same time. And they gave judgment upon him, and they slew his sons before his eyes and so forth. So at this point, it's the end. It's really the end. It's pretty much total humiliation. They put out his eyes, they bound him with fetters, carried him to Babylon. This is in the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, came Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, the servant of the king of Babylon, into Jerusalem. So now they're going to come in and do the destruction. burnt the house of the Lord and the king's house and all the houses of Jerusalem and every great man's house he burnt with fire. And all the army of the Chaldees that were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls of Jerusalem round about. And the rest of the people that were left in the city, the fugitives that fell away from to the king in Babylon with all the remnant of the multitude, did Nabuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carry away. But the captain of the guard left the poor of the land to be vine dressers and husbandmen. And then it also goes and details all the different parts of the temple, the different things that, that belonged to the temple that were also carried away. All right, so this is it. This was the end. it talks about, let's see, I don't know if it was anything I want to. It took some of the chief, the priests. You know, it still had some priests in town, so you want to take them too because they could possibly be involved in some kind of a rebellion. So you take them with you. That's down in verse 18. He took any officers that were there in verse, it says in verse 19. He took them and brought them all of the king of Babylon to Riblah, and he took all his leaders. And then in verse 21, it says the king of Babylon killed them all. He killed all the people that were taken up there. So this is like total, this is the total humiliation. This is the end. This is what God had promised punishment, and here it came. Now, why did I study this? Well, one reason is because the timing, the beginning of the siege was 8 days ago. So that made it something having to do with this time of year. I do that every once in a while. What was going on in the Bible at this time of year when it's not around feast days? So it's something I've always been curious about. But there's something else here. The Bible, the more I've come to read it and study it, I've learned that more and more that it is a narrative. It's a book that tells a story. And, all right, what is the story, especially the Old Testament? What can you say that the, any idea in a simple few words what the story of the Old Testament is? What's it talking about? What's its point? Okay, it is failures and successes of who?
Man's inability to self-rule without God.
Okay, now you're getting philosophical. That's true. That's all true. The people that were writing it, though, I don't think they were writing about that. It does do that. Yes, absolutely, absolutely true. What were they writing about? What was the story they were writing? It was a people. It was a people and their land, Israel and the land of Israel. Almost the entire, I didn't have time. I don't know if I would have done it anyway. I think I could do it on my computer. I could probably get the total number of words in the Old Testament and find out how many of them don't have to do with what I just said. You know, the first 11 chapters of Genesis don't have a whole lot to do with that. Just sets the tone for and the history of, you know, thousands of years until we get to Abraham. And then we got some chapters on Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph. And then the whole rest of the book is Israel and the land of Israel. That's the story. That's the story. The people and their land. It's the story of Israel. And I believe, and I've you know, because I like talking about this, that if we study this, we get the context. We get what world they were in when they were writing and what they were thinking about. And so this narrative in the Old Testament of this people, Israel, and their land, and the successes and failures and blessings and cursings and all those things that you mentioned, that was uppermost on their mind. That was the story they were telling. And because of what we just read, because Babylon conquered and demolished Judah, it seemed that the end result was this failure. But yet God had promised. So now, the frame of reference that I see for the people in the times of the New Testament, the time when Jesus came, is when will God restore Israel's fortunes? When will the promises be fulfilled? When will Messiah come and lead Israel to the top of the heap of nations? Why did God have to punish? What should we have learned from that? How should we live now? These are the kinds of questions, I believe, that motivated religious Jews in the time of Jesus. From the time of the exile all the way up to the time of the New Testament. Excuse me. So, this was their identity. That's why I wanted to read through the destruction, the final destruction of Judah. This was their identity. These were the people of God who had failed. God was not able to give them the promises. And now they were suffering for their sins. And when the prophets wrote, this was what was on their minds. And when the Pharisees made their rules and all the customs and traditions, this was a large part of their motivation. And when the disciples were learning from Jesus, these were the kinds of questions that they had. And in Acts 2 and verse 17, you don't need to turn there. You remember that they were speaking in different languages. They had the Holy Spirit. They felt this power. And Peter says, this is what's happened. It shall come to pass in the last days, said God, I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. And your sons and your daughters will prophesy. And your young men will see visions. And your old men will dream dreams. The excited apostles realized that God had answered all those questions, but not at all in the way they had expected. But they knew, in a way anyway, now the end was here. This was different. The Spirit was available. Eventually, not right there in Acts 2, but eventually Gentiles were going to be called into the people of God. This had to be the end time. That's what the prophets had been prophesying about hundreds of years before. It wasn't what they expected. But they knew that the kingdom, that is this time when God's Spirit would be available, this time when God would bring the Gentiles into their midst, all this time was upon them. It was here. And they awaited, they had the kingdom there in a way, but now they awaited the return of their king. And so do we. So when we read the prophets, when we read the Gospels, when we read the rest of the New Testament, let's remember the mindset of those who were doing the writing. They were waiting for God to set things right. And indeed, he has begun the process through the death and resurrection of his son. But the story isn't over yet. We'll have to stay tuned.